large extent welcomed, at least by a large section of the population. So what the Allies said in 45 or 46, I think, is not really relevant. I think what is relevant, that the Nazis found a large welcome in Austria. They found a large welcome in Germany. The Germans, after the war, eventually said, yes, this is true. And in many ways, we're to blame. The Austrians have never said that. The Austrians have always found excuses. And this idea of excuses is very difficult to take. It's very difficult for me to take. It's very difficult for many people to take. We would like a more honest, I'm saying this, I'm letting my hair down, this is an unofficial, and of course you're a minister and it's very hard for you to respond to it, I understand
no,
that.
No,
but I say that
friendly.
It would be much better if somebody said, yes, it's true. And the second thing is the thing about Waldheim, Dr. Waldheim. I honestly can't understand it. You say it wasn't proven that he did a criminal thing. Perhaps. But is that the test for electing a prime minister or a president of a country? I mean, it is proven, it seems to me, that he hid for many years the fact that he was in the German army. He said he came back to Vienna, instead he spent the time in the German army in Yugoslavia or Italy, wherever. He lied about it. All the time that he was in the United Nations, it was hidden. Now, we had a presidential candidate, Senator Biden, who misquoted, who quoted somebody and didn't attribute, and he resigned because he didn't do that. Not as large an offense, it seems to me, as having spent 3 years in the Wehrmacht and not saying anything about it at a time when he really should have. So, no matter what he did, as far as I'm concerned, in the army, whether he did this in Yugoslavia or that, is irrelevant. As far as I'm concerned, the mere fact that he lied about it should have disqualified him immediately. Number one, he should have resigned. I don't understand why he didn't. And the party that nominated him should have urged him to resign. Instead, we see a stubborn defense and a stubborn resistance and attacks on people who perhaps improperly attack him. And you may well be right. Newspaper people do that. Lots of people do that. But it's this defensiveness which I have difficulty with, and I'd like to get it behind me. I'd much rather just forget it and go on. I love to go to Vienna. I enjoy it. And I'd love to forget about it, but I need help from the Austrians.
Yeah. Please take it serious that they really respect your opinion. But we also, I don't want to act as a teacher here, really. We also should respect that there might be issues where we have differing opinions. And I don't accept a point of view just for the reason, if I believe it is not true, it would fit whatever purpose. And you said, there is no proof. Perhaps there is no proof. But if there is no proof, it is my opinion. Now I respect fully yours. And it's not just a formal remark. That without proof you cannot condemn anybody. And this applies also to somebody who is elected. Now you said Hitler came to Austria. When, because you have this, if I may say so, the Austrian background, one should know that the Austrian history is extremely complicated one. And I cannot expect, and I do not expect, that somebody abroad would know all the intricacies of the history of a very small country. This would be now a lengthy speech from me, if I go in all the details. Number one, you said a large section of the Austrian population welcomed it. To my mind, I would say too large a section as well. But for what reasons? Number one, there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands out of works. There were hundreds and hundreds of thousands despaired because there was civil war, a constitutional breach, an authoritarian regime. And there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands who thought, since on the other side of the border, everybody got work, got an income for the family, This is a tremendous upsurge, and not only the Austrians. The miner has been more than in other countries because of the cultural affinity, I agree. But there was certainly no majority, because when the Austrian Prime Minister fixed a plebiscite to have a vote of the entire population for the maintenance and existence of an independent Austria, then he finally gave the order to march to Austria, because he knew, and we know it from the papers founded after 1945, that he was sure and convinced, and his closest counselors, that the plebiscite would bring a majority against the Anschluss. I mean, there are quite some arguments. And so there is no excuse for what happened. There were those who were national socialists in welcoming, out of ideological conviction. There were those who thought, who didn't care hang for ideology, we want work. And even those two parts together did not make up a majority. And all this confirms me my conviction, not to speak of the year 1934, what I've quoted, that we were the first victims. On the 17th of July, of June 1934, the Austrian Prime Minister said, whoever is silent to what happens in Berlin to the new regime is co-responsible for this new criminal government which is instituted in Germany. It's about the quotation. And he in Berlin got furious, because this small, as I said before, non-viable country, this nothing of an Austrian Prime Minister, an extremely weak position, formulated such statement. It was merely a quotation what I said. While others, in the context of appeasement policy, went to Berlin, shook hands, photos were made, and all this stuff on. And discovered only after the 1st September of 1939, this was really a criminal regime. To sum up again, I cannot ask somebody to accept my point of view. And I won't ask somebody to accept my point of view, which probably in his family experience has gone through the greatest tragedy man can go. But I would really ask you also not to accept my point of view, but to accept that somebody speaks out of his personal conviction, and who hopes very much that this is no obstacle for coming again to Vienna.
Please forgive me for not getting up. I said that it's not
relation
to
scientific.
My name is Jerry
Berman.
A
little louder, Jerry.
I would like to go beyond wartime. I even would like to go beyond Hitler. And I would like to talk about the Vienna and the Hungarian Empire. Our end of the last century. When two men played an outstanding role.
When two men
played an outstanding role. Georg von Schönerer and Karl Lueder. Georg von Schönerer was the son of a father who was a great railroad builder in Austria, and who was to a very large extent financed by the Rothschilds. His son, Georg, the father became a villain, knight, and what now? Von Schönerer became one of the leading anti-Semites of the then Europe towards the end of the last century. A man with a tremendous influence in the German-speaking part of Austria. Karl Lueger was, if I remember correctly, three times elected mayor of Vienna and three times Franz Josef Strickmann permitted to be seated because its platform was populism and anti-Semitism. Most of us who came to Vienna see the Vienna which Duega built. He bought it, he was a, and finally was defeated, a magnificent mayor, and he bought Vienna from the age of Maria Theresia to the age of the end of the century. But their influence was so great that later, had fundamentally both of them, they are politicians who had only one strong point of view, anti-Semitism, and it was Axis methods. And they are also outstanding influence, I have to say that as a German, was that men who then had the title of Pope Xavier at the court of Philip II, his name was Adolf Stucker.
Adolf
Stucker, S-T-O-E-C-K-E-R, became one of the outstanding followers and the creator of modern anti-Semitism in Germany. Now, I know that in the great period of insecurity when the feudal ages turned into modern industrial world, that created a lot of unhappiness and a lot of hunger and a lot of misery, that people looked for somebody who was guilty. But if we discuss Hitler, and if we discuss wartime, we have to understand there is the beginning. This is a sickness that goes much deeper than just after the Second World War. And it is not only limited to German-speaking countries. There was the hotbed. But after all, the Dreyfus Affair did not develop out of nothing. And the Dreyfus Affair, to a very large extent, was a populist answer to a lost war against Prussia and the Middle
East.
Now, why do I bring all this up?
How about the question, yeah. Jerry?
In Germany, there were governments right after the war, like Adenauer, Brandt, Schmidt. They admitted this was their national policy. This is our gift. When Kohl came in, he asked for Reagan's visit to Hitler. And this is what I'm trying to say, that what Austria needed, in my opinion, today, is that not only school children are taught this development, but that it's part of the expression of the Austrian government, irrespective of party. That this did not develop as a result of wars lost won, that this is part and parcel, or was, let me say, part and parcel of the national character of both countries. And we have to deal with that, and I hope you will use your influence to bring exactly that about. Because without that, there's no guarantee that it will not happen again. Perhaps not against the Jews, but there will be somebody else who will be responsible for the
network. Want to comment? Other question?
Yeah. Except, if you permit, the last two or three sentences, I fully share your analysis. And I could be exceptionally short in my answer because I said before I'm always rather lengthy in my comments. I mean, one could even go further back, not only in the last century, but even in that area you mentioned, the transitory area to a modern industrial society with all the tensions and the populist, the polemic, and cheap approach, how to gain voters. I wrote here the names you mentioned, And I wrote here just for me two other names, very prominent politician in those years, which shows that in all major Austrian parties, there were particularly just around the change of the century prominent anti-Semites. This is a regrettable fact, and very correctly and fair, if I may say so, you pointed even to other countries, Dreyfus, Jacques, and so on and so forth. So this means, to my mind, it goes back further in history than only to those years we were discussed in our meeting up till now. But whatever the sources were and the reasons were, as it was mentioned frequently here, we should draw the conclusions from the past and do everything to combat a new resurgence of similar attitudes as they were reflected by people, Schönerer, Luega, and others I've made just for me a note here. Now one could say, Mr. Mock, why do you make notes and not quote them? In a very personal opinion, I am the successor of two People's Party chairmen who were in the concentration camp. Only with one by coincidence I could still discuss what were the implications of the horrors of a concentration camp. And I have to respect the sensibility of all those who went through this abominable situations. But he told me, you know, my conclusion, he said to me, was Fiege, is we should never forget, but we have to forgive. And I have the opinion, I cannot ask somebody who was in the concentration camp to forgive. I don't have the moral position. But I share this position of Dr. Fiege as my personal conviction. So to sum up, I share this analysis. The only thing where we differ is that it corresponds to the national character of two European peoples.
Just one second, mate, before further questions. We've only got a few more minutes. And if we can, in those few minutes, we've had a... What was that? Well, I was just going to ask if anyone had some questions or comments more directed towards what we can be doing, I guess what you're saying, what we can be doing together for the future in correcting or changing or improving on what these events and these conditions of the past. I would hope that we might direct some...
My name is Roberta Burkhan. Dr. Bach, you said that you thought the furor over President Waldheim was going to cease, and then you discovered you were mistaken. What do you personally feel Austria should do to either dissipate or end this furor over President Waldheim? What do you personally think should be done?
Yeah. If I had a perfect answer to the question, I would have sometimes...
He would have done it.
So please accept my very imperfect answer. We have to give as much room as possible to any examination as required. This was asked for by the president himself, and one of the conclusions was the institution of this commission under the chairman of the Swiss professor Dr. Kurz. The second step would be that we try with the extremely limited means we have at our disposal as 7 million people And that's why I'm grateful for this occasion to explain our position, to try the maximum to provide information. A group of people, experts, becoming experts in all this personal career of Dr. Waldheim, now wrote a so-called white book. We will distribute, we will give our knowledge, communicate our knowledge to audiences like here. And I have the feeling, also from my stay here, that at least many people in that country, I mean, of course, I meet many people who haven't heard from all the thing if you go a little bit to the West, but many people in that country are questioning themselves, what is the end of this campaign if there cannot be any real proof of implication in crimes against humanity or war crimes? Are starting to think and become sometimes even defender. Got to say, for instance, somebody said to me, I don't like him. I didn't like him already as the Secretary General of the United Nations. He had only understanding for the third world and never for the industrialized democracies and so on and so forth. But I cannot stand also the campaign against him without proof. This is a very imperfect answer, because we can do only to dissipate misunderstanding, misinformation, with very limited means. Probably I should quote a personal experience. I was last August in Auckland, in New Zealand. And I gave a speech there at the party convention. And the next day they had organized a fundraising dinner. At the very last moment, the guest speaker for the fundraising dinner, I think a political science professor from California, had to cancel his engagement, and they were, the National Party of New Zealand was in the embarrassing situation that people had paid a lot for participating in the dinner, they didn't have a guest speaker. So they came to me in the morning and said, you're coming along with an IDU delegation representative of conservative and Christian democratic parties, MPs from Great Britain, continental Europe, and so on and so forth. Couldn't at least two or three give a short speech on an interesting issue? They said, please ask them, these are all grown-up personalities. And then the deputy chairman of the Conservative Party of Britain, Great Britain, spoke for 10 minutes, and then an US ambassador spoke for 10 minutes. And then one of my colleagues from the Austrian Parliament spoke about 10 minutes. And before I took the floor, he came to me and said, in this short time, what should I discuss or deal with? And I told him, take, for instance, the function of the permanent neutrality of Austria, because sometimes it's mixed up with neutralism, semi-communism, and whatnot, and what are the functions of permanent neutrality? Then he spoke on the what means permanent neutrality, means clear adherence to the community of Western free states, but staying out of military alliances. And then he described that one of the functions is to provide a safe haven for refugees coming from other countries. And when he mentioned what I mentioned today, that among others, Hungarians and Czechs and so on and so forth, Poles, that we were the transit country for about 260,000 Jewish refugees, a lady seated on my side who was before not very eloquacious, but I didn't care so much. Only afterwards I understood the fact that he wasn't very eloquacious and didn't engage in a conversation with me. Somebody said to me, and that's true what that guy says out there. I was a little bit shocked or surprised. I said, yes, it's true. But yes, he said, but now one reads quite different things in from Austria. And I said, yes, I can understand, because you're reading, I cannot expect that you in Auckland read Austrian newspapers. And even in Austrian newspapers, for instance, you won't find it what he says, because we had agreed, as an opposition leader, I had agreed with Dr. Kreisky, we would keep, wherever we fight each other, more or less silence on this transit business for refugees, Jewish refugees, because not to attract Arab terrorism, to the camps. And then I gave her a little bit of explanation, and finally the opposition leader, who was seated in front of me on the other side of the table, said, "What was the sudden exchange you had with the lady to the left?" And I told him, and he said, "Yeah, it was. You have to count with the fact that you are denounced as a Nazi country." So I was quite conscious and aware of the extremely limited means. 7 million people country with many shortcomings, presence, in history, in many failures and mistakes, has only a very limited possibility to dissipate, as you quoted it, and to inform in this area. I don't want to decide.
My name is Bob Lawton, and I'd like to expand on this whole question of Mr. Waldheim. I want to know how he was elected Secretary General of the United Nations. I want to know how the superpowers didn't look into his historical background at that time. It was brought up that if you're a presidential candidate, they go through your history rather dramatically. I'd like to know what history is. If we are incapable, or if it's a conspiracy of silence, if this information was available in the United Nations archives and it was not looked into, I want to know at one point history will be disclosed, because as you quite correctly stated, your country has the right to elect any president it wants to, but the moral imperative of the Secretary General and the inability of the superpowers to at least say, what did this person do during the war and what is his record, that is what I don't understand.
Mr. Lord, that's getting far beyond this meeting, and I'm only going to ask Susan and then Mark.
A short response to it.
All right, you want to make a short response to it?
No, afterwards.
Afterwards, all right.
Following on what you have
Susan
said,
and then
I think
Mark.
If we want to talk about the future, let us, in these last few minutes, start talking about our common interests. You as an Austrian and we as Americans here, because you have a unique perspective as a neutral country. And I think when we consider the future, we must think about the superpowers, the international configuration. And here you are at the United Nations. Can offer us insight about the new Soviet policy of Glasnost, the effect that this can have upon Austria's role as a haven for other Central European countries, for Soviet Jews, the wonderful possibilities for peace. This perhaps can be a whole area of consideration among us, where we can share interests, where we can prove that all of us are dedicated to human rights and toward concerns for humanity to wipe out the horrors of the past.
Well, that was really a comment. You want to comment? And then I want to look at Mark Tannenbaum after you. You sum up and then we'll...
Very frankly, I don't have an answer. Because, for instance, just a detail. After the Second World War, I mean, this was a destroyed country, and Karl Gruber, the first foreign minister, Austrian resistance fighter against the Nazis, when I discussed with him later on, I think I said it in public, told me, you know, as far as collaborators were concerned, as young officials and civil servants, let's say private secretaries and so on, since we didn't have any secret service or whatsoever, we asked for clearance in 1945, CIA and others. Automatically, those who came in our offices for a ministry. And I did it not for particular reasons, because I believed him personally, Dr. Walter, but I did it automatically with Walter, and I was told, of course, by the CIA, everything is okay and is fine. So, I think your emotional remark is very justified. But I use it sometimes as an argument for our federal president. Because I say, if somebody gets in 1945, and there was active denazification by the Allied powers in Austria, and about 200 or 400, I think, Austrians were implicated in such examinations, when we were occupied for 10 years, and so on and so forth, they didn't find anything. Then he became ambassador to the United Nations. Then he became foreign minister. And then he became presidential candidate in 1971. And then he became for 10 years, twice re-elected, Secretary General of the United Nations. And then he was supposed to be re-elected again by the superpowers, if not the Chinese had said no. The United States agreed or supported him, Soviet Russia for him, and so on and so forth. By God, I say, I draw the same conclusion. What is the conclusion of this? And now you insisted again on the word future. I mean, I think that's the important thing, the important where we have common interests. But of course, I felt absolutely obliged to all questions concerning the past, because I'm in a difficult position if I avoid the past, to avoid a very difficult past. What I would say is, as a personal view, you were speaking of both superpowers. I ask you as Americans, don't use the expression both superpowers. This implies you put them on the same moral footing. Whatever the shortcomings also of these countries are, this is the first democracy on our globe, the strongest one. And its security and strength guarantees the strength of many other democracies. And whatever my engagement for détente with the East, on the other side of the fence, which is a barbed wire and a wall, there is the strongest dictatorship. So both superpowers implies they are more or less of the same quality, and there's a remarkable difference. And you should be proud of that, and one should also respect this in the proper terminology. This is no counter-argument that I say that I think the new policy or new thinking, as it's sometimes formulated, announced by Gorbachev, provides an additional chance for a further step for stability, détente, and peace, but not for more. The eternal peace we are longing for, probably there might be some generation which can fix the conditions of eternal peace. I'm not so conceited that I think I belong to a generation which for the first time in the history of humanity can say, we fix once forever eternal peace. But I think still for many years, strength of democracies is absolutely necessary to balance dictatorships, and at the same time we have to organize the dialogue. And if they say we would like more human rights, we will apply more human rights stipulations in our country, we would permit some sort of election on lower basis, as Gorbachev did, lower ranks of the party or for the Soviet parliament. And if he says he wants to open the boundaries, and if he says we should give the decision-making authority in economics to the enterprise and not to the state, that's all fine. He does it in order to strengthen his system and not to weaken it. Because, and that might be new, that he's quite aware, more than his predecessor, the weakness, the inherent weakness of the communist system. Whether this turns out to be the right way, if he applies these new elements, and whether it might not turn out, if he applies these new elements undermining his system, that's still an open question. So we should not mix up hopes and realities. We should remain strong and organize even a dialogue in the East-West, and I think, at least in this respect, an Austrian is very credible, that there's a great interest in the East-West dialogue. That's what I wanted to say to your question, what means new policy and Glasnost. Finally, since this was my last response, I want to express my gratitude for this discussion, for this extremely fair discussion, even if I understand that in many respects you might have a different position. Probably I should add that I told you an hour ago or 2 hours ago I had the delegation of a refugee, Jewish refugee support institution, which expressed the gratitude to the Austrian government for the support we're giving refugees coming from Iran. And one of the speakers of this delegation told me he knows our history from two sides. The one side is coming for to express the gratitude to the Austrian government for what we are doing in the field of refugees. And the other one, he was a 15-year-old boy in the concentration camp of Mauthausen. And I said to the consular general when we drove here, I don't know what's the proper word, I always get out of mind when I meet somebody who tells me he was 15 years of age or 12 years and he was in a concentration camp. But I think we have only a chance to work up this terrible history by probably incomplete means, but by the way Rabbi Tannenbaum proposed when he came to Vienna, and by the sayings I quoted Fiegel, and by the saying of Martin Buber that the dialogue is the most human means of solving problems. With this conviction I want to thank you very much for receiving me so friendly, Schatten hospitality, and with this conviction I hope very much that you come again to Vienna.
Very grateful for this opportunity, and I'd like Mark to close the meeting, please.
I had thought that 2 months of activity in relation to the Vatican and Pope John Paul II, I had pretty much exhausted complexity. There are other levels of complexity. But I want to say that just as I believe as the experience in Rome and Castel Gandolfo and then in Miami led to this sense that you quoted Martin Buber, one of his famous phrases, which is essentially what you're saying, is that all real living is meeting as persons, not as caricatures, not as stereotypes, not as abstractions, but as human beings in all their complexity. I think you have been a superb demonstration of honesty and candor and forthrightness about some of the most difficult issues that both of our peoples need to face together, and we're very grateful for that. I simply want to make 2 very brief comments. Dr. Mott was kind enough to refer to courage, riskiness, etc. I think that's true, but those are really the easiest things to engage in. What I think motivated the American Jewish Committee, what has motivated us from our very beginning, is a fundamental commitment to something at the core of democracy and the core of Judaism and Jewish humanism. And that is a conviction that one cannot build history on lies. One has a commitment to truth. And it became increasingly clear to us, with all of the difficulty and all of the debate and all the polarization over Austria and Dr. Waldheim and what was going on in the face of that, that we had a primary obligation to face certain truths about contemporary Austria. And one of those truths is that the population of Austria today consists 2/3 of Austrians born either during the war or since the war. And we have an obligation as Jews and as Americans, Jews who know the meaning of collective schuld, of what the charge of collective guilt has meant to us. We have lost millions of our people and rivers of Jewish blood for the charge of Jews as Christ killers and the collective guilt of the Jewish people across the centuries. The Talmud tells us that that which has been afflicted upon you, you must not afflict upon others. And we have a responsibility to face plain, simple demographic fact that two-thirds of Austrian people today had personally nothing whatsoever to do with the Nazi Holocaust. And we have an obligation to see to it that they are not collectively indicted for that which others, their parents and grandparents, may have been responsible for. There is an obligation to the future. We know now, from our experiences with young Christians in various countries of Europe who were involved in the Nazi Holocaust, that there is a parallel search for truth and honesty on the part of millions of young non-Jewish people, Catholics, Protestants, Evangelicals, and others, throughout Europe, Germany, France, Italy, and elsewhere, who want to overcome the shame of the silence of the past, to face the past, not in order to engage in masochism or self-affliction, but to learn lessons of how to identify the sources of evil as they begin to sprout, the sources of demonology, of the undermining of constitutional democracy, and to build in the safeguards to assure that that will not happen in their countries, because they have as great a stake in democracy as we have. We have an obligation as people committed to constitutional democracy and human rights, not only in our own country but throughout the world, to support, to confirm those people in Austria, in Germany, in France, in Italy, and elsewhere who are committed to those ideals and values, without which human society will not survive as a civilized society. And it's because of that sense of reality, and because we have met people, such as those representatives of the Austrian government who are here today, and others whom we've met in Austria, that we are confident, without ignoring the difficulties and the complexities, that there exists a very profound basis for us, in all honesty, to face the past, not with a view toward mutual incrimination, but with a view toward learning that lesson together, and to build a common future that is based on fundamental respect for human dignity and civil and political liberties. I think today has really been, in many ways, an extraordinary encounter. I think, as Dr. Mock has rightly said, there's been a kind of honesty about this and a sense of decency and fairness about this discussion, even with all of the difficult discussions that we've had. And frankly, I think this is what has been missing. This kind of encounter is what has been missing in the relationship between Austrians and certainly American Jews. Schlachtsammet is no substitute for that. Exhibits are no substitute for that. And in fact, the degree to which one believes that one can move forward with exhibits and bringing horses and choirs, lovely as they are, and symphonies and orchestras, it is this kind of encounter, even this taste of that encounter, that must begin to take place between centers of Jewish population in this country and between Austrians. And it's our hope and prayer that the meeting that will begin in January, that symposium, with leaders of Austrian society and American Jewish scholars and leaders, that discussion forward. We are now looking forward, in fact, some recent discussions to even further symposiums, which hopefully will take place in the future. I feel very confident about what our possibilities are, given the sense of what has happened here today. And I know I express for myself, hopefully for others, our very profound appreciation to you for taking the time out of your heavy schedule, you and your colleagues, to join us today. This is the period of 10 days of repentance in Jewish tradition. And one of the key themes in this period of 10 days of repentance is a recognition of the phrase, Dvarim sheyotzim min alev nichnasim min alev. Words that come from the heart, enter the heart, penetrate the heart. And I think that's been that heart-to-heart experience today, and we thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.